content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hey everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Welcome back to our series on J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker magazine. This week, we will finish the story we started last week, published in the New Yorker magazine in January 29, 1955, Franny by J.D. Salinger. To recap what happened last week, Franny is a story about a college boy and his girlfriend, Franny, who has come to Yale to spend the weekend with him. In her last letter, she said she longed to see him and alludes to a night they made love. After she arrives, they go to a restaurant for lunch. Their conversation is intellectual, and they disagree on everything. Franny apologizes over and over, saying she is in an off mood. She feels guilty because she has no warm feelings for him. She turns pale and goes to the restroom, where she weeps for a while, holding a seemingly precious book to her bosom. She returns to the table, composed, and tells Lane how fascinated she is with this book, which concerns a man who learned how to pray incessantly by saying over and over to himself, "God have mercy on me." Lane had started in on his frog legs. "Well, what was the book, anyway? Or is it a goddamn secret or something?" he asked. "The little book in my bag," Franny said. She watched him disjoint a pair of frog legs. Then she took a cigarette from the pack on the table and lit herself. "Oh, I don't know," she said. "It's something called The Way of a Pilgrim." She watched Lane eat for a moment. "I got it out of the library. This man that teaches this religion survey thing I'm taking this term mentioned it." She dragged on her cigarette. "I've had it out for weeks. I keep forgetting to return it." "Who wrote it?" "I don't know," Franny said casually. "Some Russian peasant, apparently." She went on watching Lane eat his frog legs. "He never gives his name. You never know his name the whole time he's telling the story. He just tells you he's a peasant and that he's 33 years old and that he's got a withered arm and that his wife is dead. It's all in the 1800s. Lane had just shifted his attention from the frog legs to the salad. "Any good?" he asked. "What's it about?" "I don't know. It's peculiar. I mean, it's primarily a religious book. In a way, I suppose you could say it's terribly fanatical, but in a way it isn't. I mean, it starts out with this peasant, the pilgrim, wanting to find out what it means in the Bible when it says you should pray incessantly. You know, without stopping. In Thessalonians or someplace, so he starts out walking all over Russia, looking for somebody who can tell him how to pray incessantly. And what you should say if you do." Franny seemed intensely interested in the way Lane was dismembering his frog legs. Her eyes remained fixed on his plate as she spoke. "All he carries with him is this knapsack filled with bread and salt. Then he meets this person called a Steretz, some sort of terribly advanced religious person, and the Steretz tells him about a book called the Philokalia, which apparently was written by a group of terribly advanced monks who sort of advocated this really incredible method of praying."
"Hold still," Lane said to a pair of frog's legs.
"Anyway, so the pilgrim learns how to pray the way these very mystical persons say you should. I mean, he keeps at it till he's perfected it and everything. And then he goes on walking all over Russia, meeting all kinds of absolutely marvelous people and telling them how to pray by this incredible method. I mean, that's really the whole book."
"I hate to mention it, but I'm going to reek of garlic," Lane said.
"He meets this one married couple on one of his journeys that I love more than anybody I've ever read about in my entire life," Franny said. "He's walking down a road somewhere in the country with his knapsack on his back when these two tiny little children run after him shouting, 'Dear little beggar, dear little beggar, you must come home to mummy. She likes beggars.' So he goes home with the children, and this really lovely person, the children's mother, comes out of the house all in a bustle and insists on helping him take off his dirty old boots and giving him a cup of tea. Then the father comes home, and apparently he loves beggars and pilgrims too, and they all sit down to dinner. And while they're at dinner, the pilgrim wants to know who all the ladies are that are sitting around the table. And the husband tells him that they are all servants, but that they always sit down to eat with him and his wife because they're sisters in Christ.
Franny suddenly sat up, a trifle straighter in her seat, self-consciously.
I mean, I loved the pilgrim wanting to know who all the ladies were.
She watched Lane butter a piece of bread.
Anyway, after that, the pilgrim stays overnight, and he and the husband sit up till late talking about this method of praying without ceasing. The pilgrim tells him how to do it. Then he leaves in the morning and starts out on some more adventures. He meets all kinds of people. I mean, that's the whole book, really, and he tells all of them how to pray by this special way.
Lane nodded. He cut into his salad with his fork. I hope to God we get time over the weekend so you can take a quick look at this goddamn paper I told you about, he said. I don't know. I may not do a damn thing with it. I mean, try to publish it or what have you. But I'd like you to sort of glance through it while you're here.
Well, I'd love to, Franny said. She watched him butter another piece of bread. You might like this book, she said suddenly. It's so simple, I mean.
Sounds interesting. You don't want your butter, do you?
No, take it. Can't lend it to you because it's way overdue already, but you could probably get it at the library here. I'm positive you could.
You haven't touched your goddamn sandwich, Lane said suddenly. You know that?
Franny looked down at her plate as if it had just been placed before her. I will in a minute, she said.
She sat still for a moment, holding her cigarette, but without dragging on it in her left hand and with her right hand fixed tensely around the base of the glass of milk.
Do you want to hear what the special method of praying was that the Starets told him about, she asked. It's really sort of interesting in a way.
Lane cut into his last pair of frog slates. He nodded. Sure, he said, sure.
Well, as I said, the pilgrim, this simple peasant, started the whole pilgrimage to find out what it means in the Bible when it says you're supposed to pray without ceasing. And then he meets his Starets, this very advanced religious person I mentioned, the one who'd been studying the Philokalia for years and years and years.
Franny stops suddenly to reflect, to organize.
Well, the Starets tells him about the Jesus prayer first of all. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. I mean, that's what it is. And he explains to him that those are the best words to use when you pray, especially the word mercy, because it's such a really enormous word and can mean so many things. I mean, it doesn't just have to mean mercy.
Franny paused to reflect again. She was no longer looking at Lane's plate, but over his shoulder.
Anyway, she went on, the Starets tells the pilgrim that if you keep saying that prayer over and over again, you only have to just do it with your lips at first. Then eventually, what happens? The prayer becomes self-active. Something happens after a while. I don't know what, but something happens, and the words get synchronized with the person's heartbeats. And then you're actually praying without ceasing, which has a really tremendous mystical effect on your whole outlook. I mean, that's the whole point of it, more or less. I mean, you do it to purify your whole outlook and get an absolutely new conception of what everything's about.
Lane had finished eating. Now, as Franny paused again, he sat back and lit a cigarette and watched her face. She was still looking abstractedly ahead of her, past his shoulder, and seemed scarcely aware of his presence.
But the thing is, the marvelous thing is, when you first start doing it, you don't even have to have faith in what you're doing. I mean, even if you're terribly embarrassed about the whole thing, it's perfectly all right. I mean, you're not insulting anybody or anything. In other words, nobody asks you to believe a single thing when you first start out. You don't even have to think about what you're saying. All you have to have in the beginning is quantity. Then later on, it becomes quality by itself, on its own power or something. He says that any name of God, any name at all, has this peculiar self-active power of its own, and it starts working after you've sort of started it up.
Lane sat rather slouched in his chair, smoking. His eyes narrowed attentively at Franny's face. Her face was still pale, but it had been paler at other moments since the two had been in Sicklers.
As a matter of fact, that makes absolute sense, Franny said, because in the Nimbutsu sects of Buddhism, people keep saying Namu Amida Butsu over and over again, which means praises to the Buddha, or something like that. And the same thing happens. The exact same, easy, take it easy. In the first place, you're going to burn your fingers any second. Franny gave a minimal glance down at her left hand and dropped the stub of her still-burning cigarette into the ashtray. The same thing happens in the cloud of unknowing, too, just with the word God. I mean, you just keep saying the word God. She looked at Lane more directly than she had in several minutes. I mean, the point is, did you ever hear anything so fascinating in your life, in a way? I mean, it's so hard to just say it's absolute coincidence and then just let it go with that. That's what's so fascinating to me. At least, that's what's so terribly... She broke off. Lane was shifting restively in his chair, and there was an expression on his face. A matter of raised eyebrows, chiefly, that she knew very well. What's the matter? She asked. You actually believe that stuff, or what? Franny reached for the pack of cigarettes and took one out. I didn't say I believed it or I didn't believe it, she said, and scanned the table for the folder of matches. I said it was fascinating. She accepted a light from Lane. I just think it's a terribly peculiar coincidence, she said, exhaling smoke, that you keep running into that kind of advice. I mean, all these really advanced and absolutely unbogus religious persons that keep telling you, if you repeat the name of God incessantly, something happens. Even in India. In India, they tell you to meditate on the Om, which means the same thing, really, and the exact same result is supposed to happen. So, I mean, you can't just rationalize it away without even... What is the result? Lane said shortly. What? I mean, what is the result that's supposed to follow? All this synchronization business and mumbo-jumbo? You get heart trouble? I don't know if you know it, but you could do yourself... Somebody could do himself a great deal of real... You get to see God. Something happens in some absolutely non-physical part of the heart. Where the Hindus say that Atman resides, if you ever took any religion, and you see God, that's all. She flicked her cigarette ash self-consciously, just missing the ashtray. She picked up the ash with her fingers and put it in. And don't ask me who or what God is. I mean, I don't even know if he exists. When I was little, I used to think... She stopped. The waiter had come to take away the dishes and redistribute menus. You want some dessert or coffee? Lane asked. I think I'll just finish my milk, but you have some, Franny said. The waiter had just taken away her plate with the untouched chicken sandwich. She didn't dare to look up at it. Lane looked at his wristwatch. God, we don't have any time. We're lucky if we get to the game on time. He looked up at the waiter. Just coffee for me, please. He watched the waiter leave, then leaned forward, arms on the table, thoroughly relaxed, stomach full, coffee due to arrive momentarily, and said, Well, it's interesting anyway, all that stuff. I don't think you leave any margin for the most elementary psychology. I mean, I think all those religious experiences have a very obvious psychological background. You know what I mean? It's interesting, though. I mean, you can't deny that. He looked over at Franny and smiled at her. Anyway, just in case I forgot to mention it, I love you. Did I get around to mentioning that? Lane, would you excuse me again for just a second? Franny said. She got up before the question was completely out. Lane got up too, slowly looking at her. You all right? He asked. You feel sick again or what? Just funny. I'll be right back. She walked briskly through the dining room, taking the same route she had taken earlier. But she stopped quite short at the small cocktail bar at the far end of the room. The bartender, who was wiping a sherry glass dry, looked at her. She put her right hand on the bar, then lowered her head, bowed it, and put her left hand to her forehead, chest touching it with the fingertips. She weaved a trifle, then fainted, collapsing to the floor. It was nearly 5 minutes before Franny came thoroughly to. She was on a couch in the manager's office, and Lane was sitting beside her. His face, suspended anxiously over hers, had a remarkable pallor of its own now. How are you? He said in a rather hospital room voice. You feel any better? Franny nodded. She closed her eyes for a second against the overhead light and then reopened them.
Am I supposed to say, where am I? She said, where am I? Blaine laughed. You're in the manager's office. They're all running around looking for spirits of ammonia and doctors and things to bring you to. They just ran out of ammonia, apparently. How do you feel? No kidding. Fine. Stupid, but fine. Did I honestly faint? And how? You really conked out, Lane said. He took her hand in his. What do you think's the matter with you, anyway? I mean, you sounded so, you know, so perfect when I talked to you on the phone last week. Didn't you eat any breakfast, or what? Franny shrugged. Her eyes looked around the room. It's so embarrassing, she said. Did somebody have to carry me in here? The bartender and I, we sort of hoisted you in. You scared the hell out of me. I'm not kidding. Franny looked thoughtfully, without blinking, at the ceiling while her hand was held. Then she turned and, with her free hand, made a gesture as though to push back the cuff of Lane's sleeve. What time is it? She asked. Never mind that, said Lane. We're in no hurry. You wanted to go to that cocktail party. Oh, the hell with it. Is it too late for the game, too? Franny asked. Listen, I said the hell with it. You're going to go back to your room at Hoosis Blue Shutters and get some rest. That's the important. He sat a trifle closer to her and bent down and kissed her briefly. He turned and looked over at the door, then back at Franny. You're just going to rest this afternoon. That's all you're going to do. He stroked her arm for a moment. Then, maybe, after a while, if you get any decent rest, I can get upstairs somehow. I think there's a goddamn back staircase. I can find it. Franny didn't say anything. She looked at the ceiling. You know how long it's been? Lane said. When was that Friday night? Way the hell early last month, wasn't it? He shook his head. That's no good. Too goddamn long between drinks, to put it crassly. He looked down at Franny more closely. You really feel better? She nodded. She turned her head toward him. I'm terribly thirsty, that's all. Do you think I could have some water? Would that be too much trouble? Hell no. Will you be all right if I leave you for a second? You know what I think I'll do? Franny shook her head to the second question. I'll get somebody to bring you some water. Then I'll get the head waiter and call off the spirits of ammonia and incidentally pay the check. Then I'll get a cab all ready so we won't have to hunt all around for one. It may take a few minutes because most of them will be cruising around for people going out to the game. He let go Franny's hand and got up. Okay, he said. Fine. Okay, I'll be right back. Don't move. He left the room. Alone, Franny lay quite still, looking at the ceiling. Her lips began to move, forming soundless words, and they continued to move. And now, from the Annals of Inquiry section of the October 10th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Becoming You, Are You the Same Person You Were When You Were a Child? By Joshua Rothman. I have few memories of being four, a fact I find disconcerting now that I am the father of a four-year-old. My son and I have great times together. Lately, we've been building Lego versions of familiar places, the coffee shop, the bathroom, and perfecting the flipperoo, a move in which I hold his hands while he somersaults backward from my shoulders to the ground. But how much of our joyous life will he remember? What I recall from when I was four are the red-painted nails of a mean babysitter, the brushed silver stereo in my parents' apartment, a particular orange-carpeted hallway, some houseplants in the sun, and a glimpse of my father's face, perhaps smuggled into memory from a photograph. These disconnected images don't knit together into a picture of life. They also fail to illuminate any inner reality. I have no memories of my own feelings, thoughts, or personality. I'm told that I was a cheerful, talkative child given to long dinner table speeches, but don't remember being so. My son, who is happy and voluble, is so much fun to be around that I sometimes mourn, on his behalf, his future inability to remember himself. If we could see our childish selves more clearly,
We might have a better sense of the course and the character of our lives. Are we the same people at 4 that we will be at 24, 44, or 74? Or will we change substantially through time? Is the fix already in, or will our stories have surprising twists and turns? Some people feel that they've altered profoundly through the years, and to them the past seems like a foreign country, characterized by peculiar customs, values, and tastes. Those boyfriends, that music, those outfits. But others have a strong sense of connection with their younger selves, and for them the past remains a home. My mother-in-law, who lives not far from her parents' house in the same town where she grew up, insists that she is the same as she's always been, and recalls with fresh indignation her 6th birthday when she was promised a pony, but didn't get one. Her brother holds the opposite view. He looks back on several distinct epochs in his life, each with its own set of attitudes, circumstances, and friends. "I've walked through many doorways," he's told me. "I feel this way too, although most people who know me well say that I've been the same person forever." Try to remember life as you lived it years ago, on a typical day in the fall. Back then, you cared deeply about certain things, a girlfriend, Depeche Mode, but were oblivious of others, your political commitments, your children. Certain key events, college, war, marriage, Alcoholics Anonymous, hadn't yet occurred. Does the self you remember feel like you or like a stranger? Do you seem to be remembering yesterday or reading a novel about a fictional character? If you had the former feelings, you're probably a continuer. If the latter, you're probably a divider. You might prefer being one to the other, but find it hard to shift your perspective. In the poem, The Rainbow, William Wordsworth wrote that, "The child is father of the man." And this motto is often quoted as truth. But he couched the idea as an aspiration, "and I could wish my days to be bound each to each by natural piety," as if to say that though it would be nice if our childhoods and adulthoods were connected like the ends of a rainbow, the connection could be an illusion that depends on where we stand. One reason to go to a high school reunion is to feel like one's past self. Old friendships resume, old in-jokes resurface, old crushes reignite. But the time travel ceases when you step out of the gym. It turns out that you've changed after all. On the other hand, some of us want to disconnect from our past selves. Burdened by who we used to be or caged by who we are, we wish for multi-part lives. In the voluminous autobiographical novel My Struggle, Carl Ove Nosgard, a middle-aged man who hopes to be better today than he was as a young man, questions whether it even makes sense to use the same name over a lifetime. Looking at a photograph of himself as an infant, he wonders what that little person, with arms and legs spread and a face distorted into a scream, really has to do with the 40-year-old father and writer he is now, or with the gray, hunched geriatric who in 40 years from now might be sitting dribbling and trembling in an old people's home. It might be better, he suggests, to adopt a series of names. The fetus might be called Jens Ove, for example, and the infant Nils Ove, the 10 to 12-year-old Geir Ove, the 12 to 17-year-old Kurt Ove, the 23 to 32-year-old Tor Ove, the 32 to 46-year-old Carl Ove, and so on. In such a scheme, the first name would represent the distinctiveness of the age range, the middle name would represent continuity, and the last, family affiliation. My son's name is Peter. It unnerves me to think that he could someday become so different as to warrant a new name. But he learns and grows each day. How could he not be always becoming someone new? I have dueling aspirations for him. Keep growing. Keep being you. As for how he'll see himself, who knows? The philosopher Galen Strawson believes that some people are simply more episodic than others. They're fine living day to day without regard to the broader plot arc. I'm somewhere down towards the episodic end of this spectrum, Strawson writes in an essay called The Sense of the Self. I have no sense of my life as a narrative with form and little interest in my own past. Perhaps Peter will grow up to be an episodic person who lives in the moment, unconcerned with whether his life forms a whole or a collection of parts. Even so, there will be no escaping the paradoxes of mutability, which have a way of weaving themselves into our lives. Thinking of some old shameful act of ours, we tell ourselves, I've changed. But have we? Bored with a friend who's obsessed with what happened long ago, we say, that was another life. You're a different person now. But is she? Living alongside our friends, spouses, parents, and children, we wonder if they're the same people we've always known, or if they've lived through changes we or they struggle to see. Even as we work tirelessly to improve, we find that wherever we go, there we are, in which case, what's the point? And yet sometimes we recall our former selves with a sense of wonder, as if remembering a past life. Lives are long and hard to see. What can we learn by asking if we've always been who we are? The question of our continuity has an empirical side that can be answered scientifically. In the 1970s, while working at the University of Otago in New Zealand, a psychologist named Phil Silva helped launch a study of 1,037 children, all of whom lived in or around the city of Dunedin. Were studied at age 3 and again at 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, 15, 18, 21, 26, 32, 38, and 45 by researchers who often interviewed not just the subjects, but also their family and friends. In 2020, four psychologists associated with the Dunedin study, Jay Belsky, Avshalom Kaspi, Terry E. Moffitt, and Richie Poulton, summarized what's been learned so far in a book called The Origins of You: How Childhood Shapes Later Life. It folds in results from a few related studies conducted in the United States and the United Kingdom, and so describes how about 4,000 people have changed through the decades. John Stuart Mill once wrote that a young person is like a tree which requires to grow and develop itself on all sides, according to the tendency of the inward forces which make it a living thing. The image suggests a generalized spreading out and reaching up, which is bound to be affected by soil and climate, and might be aided by a little judicious pruning here and there. The authors of The Origins of You offer a more chaotic metaphor. Human beings, they suggest, are like storm systems. Each individual storm has its own particular set of traits and dynamics. Meanwhile, its future depends on numerous elements of atmosphere and landscape. The fate of any given Harvey, Allison, Ike, or Katrina might be shaped in part by air pressure in another locale and by the time that the hurricane spends out at sea, picking up moisture before making landfall. Donald Trump, in 2014, told a biographer that he was the same person in his 60s that he'd been as a first grader. In his case, the researchers write, the idea isn't so hard to believe. Storms, however, are shaped by the world and by other storms, and only an egomaniacal weather system believes in its absolute and unchanging individuality. Efforts to understand human weather, to show, for example, that children who are abused bear the mark of that abuse as adults, are predictably inexact. One problem is that many studies of development are retrospective in nature. Researchers start with how people are doing now and then look to the past to find out how they got that way. But many issues trouble such efforts. There's the fallibility of memory. People often have difficulty recalling even basic facts about what they lived through decades earlier. There's also the problem of enrollment bias. A retrospective study of anxious adults might find that many of them grew up with divorced parents. But what about the many children of divorce who didn't develop anxiety and so were never enrolled in the study? It's hard for a retrospective study to establish the true import of any single factor. The value of the Dunedin Project, therefore, derives not just from its long duration, but also from the fact that it is prospective.
It began with 1,000 random children and only later identified changes as they emerged. Working prospectively, the Dunedin researchers began by categorizing their 3-year-olds. They met with the children for 90 minutes each, rating them on 22 aspects of personality. They then used their results to identify 5 general types of children. 40% of the kids were deemed well-adjusted, with the usual mixture of kid personality traits. Another quarter were found to be confident, more than usually comfortable with strangers in new situations. 15% were reserved or standoffish at first. About 1 in 10 turned out to be inhibited. The same proportion were identified as under-controlled. The inhibited kids were notably shy and exceptionally slow to warm up. The under-controlled ones were impulsive and ornery. These determinations of personality, arrived at after brief encounters and by strangers, would form the basis for a half-century of further work. By age 18, certain patterns were visible. Although the confident, reserved, and well-adjusted children continued to be that way, those categories were less distinct. In contrast, the kids who'd been categorized as inhibited or under-controlled had stayed truer to themselves. At age 18, the once inhibited kids remained a little apart and were significantly less forceful and decisive than all the other children. The under-controlled kids, meanwhile, described themselves as danger-seeking and impulsive, and were the least likely of all young adults to avoid harmful, exciting, and dangerous situations or to behave in reflective, cautious, careful, or planful ways. Teenagers in this last group tended to get angry more often and to see themselves as mistreated and victimized. The researchers saw an opportunity to streamline their categories. They lumped together the large group of teenagers who didn't seem to be on a set path. Then they focused on 2 smaller groups that stood out. One group was moving away from the world, embracing a way of life that, though it could be perfectly rewarding, was also low-key and circumspect. And another, similarly sized group, was moving against the world. In subsequent years, the researchers found that people in the latter group were more likely to get fired from their jobs and to have gambling problems. Their dispositions were durable. That durability is due, in part, to the social power of temperament, which the authors write is a machine that designs another machine, which goes on to influence development. This second machine is a person's social environment. Someone who moves against the world will push others away, and he'll tend to interpret the actions of even well-meaning others as pushing back. This negative social feedback will deepen his oppositional stance. Meanwhile, he'll engage in what psychologists call niche picking, the favoring of social situations that reinforce one's disposition. A well-adjusted fifth grader might actually look forward to the transition to middle school. When she gets there, she might even join some clubs. Her friend, who's moving away from the world, might prefer to read at lunch. And her brother, who's moving against the world, the group skews slightly male, will feel most at home in dangerous situations. Through such self-development, the authors write, we curate lives that make us ever more like ourselves. But there are ways to break out of the cycle. One way in which people change course is through their intimate relationships. The Dunedin study suggests that if someone who tends to move against the world marries the right person or finds the right mentor, he might begin to move in a more positive direction. His world will have become a more beneficent co-creation. Even if much of the story is written, a rewrite is always possible. The Dunedin study tells us a lot about how differences between children matter over time. But how much can this kind of work reveal about the deeper, more personal question of our own continuity or changeability? That depends on what we mean when we ask who we are. We are, after all, more than our dispositions. All of us fit into any number of categories, but those categories don't fully encompass our identities. There's an important sense, first of all, in which who you are is determined not by what you're like, but by what you do. Imagine 2 brothers who grow up
sharing a bedroom and who have similar personalities, intelligent, tough, commanding, and ambitious. One becomes a state senator and university president, while the other becomes a mob boss. Do their parallel temperaments make them similar people? Those who follow the stories of William Bulger and James Whitey Bulger, the Boston brothers who ran the Massachusetts Senate and the underworld respectively, sometimes suggest that they were more alike than different. They're both very tough in their respective fields, a biographer observed. But we'd be right to be skeptical of such an outlook because it requires setting aside the wildly different substances of the brothers' lives. At the pearly gates, no one will get them confused. The Bulger brothers are extraordinary. Few of us break so bad or good. But we all do surprising things that matter. In 1964, the director Michael Apted helped make Seven Up, the first of a series of documentaries that would visit the same group of a dozen or so Britons every 7 years, starting at age seven. Apted envisioned the project, which was updated most recently in 2019 with 63 Up, as a socioeconomic inquiry about these kids who have it all and these other kids who have nothing. But as the series has progressed, the chaos of individuality has encroached on the clarity of categorization. One participant has become a lay minister and gone into politics. Another has begun helping orphans in Bulgaria. Others have done amateur theater, studied nuclear fusion, and started rock bands. One turned into a documentarian himself and quit the project. Real life, irrepressible in its particulars, has overpowered the schematic intentions of the filmmakers. Even seemingly unimportant or trivial elements can contribute to who we are. Late this summer, I attended a family function with my father and my uncle. As we sat at an outside table, making small talk, our conversation turned to Star Trek, the sci-fi TV show that premiered in 1966. My father and uncle have both watched various incarnations of it since childhood, and my dad, in particular, is a genuine fan. While the party went on around us, we all recited from memory the original version's opening monologue, "Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise," and applauded ourselves and our rendition. Star Trek is a through line in my dad's life. We tend to downplay these sorts of quirks and enthusiasms, but they're important to who we are. When Leopold Bloom, the protagonist of James Joyce's Ulysses, wanders through a Dublin cemetery, he is unimpressed by the generic inscriptions on the gravestones and thinks they should be more specific. "So-and-so wheelwright," Bloom imagines, or on a stone engraved with a saucepan, "I cooked good Irish stew." As to describe ourselves, we might tend to talk in general terms, finding the details of our lives somehow embarrassing. But a friend delivering an eulogy would do well to note that we played guitar, collected antique telephones, and loved Agatha Christie and the Mets. Each assemblage of details is like a fingerprint. Some of us have had the same prints throughout our lives. Others have had a few sets. Focusing on the actualities of our lives might belie our intuitions about our own continuity or changeability. Galen Strawson, the philosopher who says that he has little sense of his life as a narrative, is best known for the arguments he's made against the ideas of free will and moral responsibility. He maintains that we don't have free will and aren't ultimately responsible for what we do. But his father, Peter Strawson, was also a philosopher and was famous for, among other things, defending those concepts. Galen Strawson can assure us that, from a first-person perspective, his life feels episodic. Yet, from the third-person perspective of an imagined biographer, he's part of a long plot arc that stretches across lifetimes. We may feel discontinuous on the inside, but be continuous on the outside and vice versa. That sort of divergence may simply be unavoidable. Every life can probably be viewed from two angles. I know two Tims, and they have opposing intuitions about their own continuities.
The first Tim, my father-in-law, is sure that he's had the same jovially jousting personality from 2 to 72. He's also had the same interest, reading the Second World War, Ireland, the Wild West, the Yankees, for most of his life. He is the one of the most self-consistent people I know. The second Tim, my high school friend, sees his life as radically discontinuous, and rightly so. When I first met him, he was so skinny that he was turned away from a blood drive for being underweight. Bullied and pushed around by bigger kids, he took solace in the idea that his parents were late growers. This notion struck his friends as far-fetched, but after high school, Tim suddenly transformed into a towering man with an action hero physique. He studied physics and philosophy in college, and then worked in a neuroscience lab before becoming an officer in the Marines and going to Iraq. He entered finance, but he has since left to study computer science. "I've changed more than most people I know," Tim told me. He shared a vivid memory of a conversation he had with his mother while they sat in the car outside an auto mechanic's. "I was 13, and we were talking about how people change, and my mom, who's a psychiatrist, told me that people tend to stop changing so much when they get into their 30s. They start to accept who they are and to live with themselves as they are, and maybe because I was an unhappy and angry person at that time, I found that idea offensive. And I vowed right then that I would never stop changing, and I haven't stopped." Do the two Tims have the whole picture? I've known my father-in-law for only 20 of his 72 years, but even in that time, he's changed quite a bit, becoming more patient and compassionate. And by all accounts, the life he lived before I met him had a few chapters of its own, too. And there's a fundamental sense in which my high school friend hasn't changed. For as long as I've known him, he's been committed to the idea of becoming different. For him, true transformation would require settling down. Endless change is a kind of consistency. Galen Strawson notes that there's a wide range of ways in which people can relate to time in their lives. Some people live in a narrative mode, he writes, and others have no tendency to see their life as constituting a story or development. But it's not just a matter of being a continuer or a divider. Some people live episodically as a form of spiritual discipline, while others are simply aimless. Presentism can be a response to economic destitution, a devastating lack of opportunities, or vast wealth. He continues as follows. There are lotus eaters, drifters, lilies of the field, mystics, and people who work hard in the present moment. Some people are creative, although they lack ambition or long-term aims, and go from one small thing to the next, or produce large works without planning to, by accident or accretion. Some people are very consistent in character, whether or not they know it, a form of steadiness that may underwrite experience of the self's continuity. Others are consistent in their inconsistency and feel themselves to be continually puzzling and piecemeal. The stories we tell ourselves about whether we've changed are bound to be simpler than the elusive reality. But that's not to say that they're inert. My friend Tim's story, in which he vows to change forever, shows how such stories can be laden with value. Whether you perceive stasis or segmentation is almost an ideological question. To be changeable is to be unpredictable and free. It's to be not just the protagonist of your life story, but the author of its plot. In some cases, it means embracing a drama of vulnerability, decision, and transformation. It may also involve a refusal to accept the finitude that's the flip side of the individuality. The alternative perspective, that you've always been who you are, bears values too. James Fenton captures some of them in his poem, The Ideal. A self is a self. It is not a screen. A person should respect what he has been. This is my past, which I shall not discard. This is the ideal. This is hard. In this view, life is full and variable, and we all go through adventures that may change who we are. But what matters most is that we have lived it. The same me, however altered, absorbed it all and did it all. This outlook also involves a declaration of independence. Independence not from one's past self and circumstances, but from the power of circumstances and the choices we make to give meaning to our lives. Dividers tell the story of how they've renovated their houses, becoming architects along the way. Continuers tell the story of an august property that will remain itself regardless of what gets built. As different as these two views sound, they have a lot in common. Among other things, they aid us in our self-development. By committing himself to a life of change, my friend Tim might have sped it along. By concentrating on his persistence of character, my father-in-law may have nurtured and refined his best self. The passage of time almost demands that we tell some sort of story. There are certain ways in which we can't help changing through life, and we must respond to them. Young bodies differ from old ones. Possibilities multiply in our early decades and later fade. When you were 17, you practiced the piano for an hour each day and fell in love for the first time. Now you pay down your credit cards and watch Amazon Prime. To say that you are the same person today that you were decades ago is absurd. A story that neatly divides your past into chapters may also be artificial, and yet there's value in imposing order on chaos. It's not just a matter of self-soothing. The future looms, and we must decide how to act based on the past. You can't continue a story without first writing one. Sticking with any single account of your mutability may be limiting. The stories we've told may become too narrow for our needs. In the book Life is Hard, the philosopher Kieran Satya argues that certain bracing challenges, loneliness, failure, ill health, grief, and so on, are essentially unavoidable. We tend to be educated. Meanwhile, in a broadly redemptive tradition that urges us to focus on the best in life. One of the benefits of asserting that we've always been who we are is that it helps us gloss over the disruptive developments that have upended our lives. But it's good, the book shows, to acknowledge hard experiences and ask how they've helped us grow tougher, kinder, and wiser. More generally, if you've long answered the question of continuity one way, you might try answering it another. For a change, see yourself as either more continuous or less continuous than you'd assumed. Find out what this new perspective reveals. There's a recursive quality to acts of self-narration. I tell myself a story about myself in order to synchronize myself with the tale I'm telling. Then, inevitably, I revise the story as I change. The long work of revising might itself be a source of continuity in our lives. One of the participants in the Up series, called Tales Apted, it's taken me virtually 60 years to understand who I am. Martin Heidegger, the often impenetrable German philosopher, argued that what distinguishes human beings is our ability to take a stand on what and who we are. In fact, we have no choice but to ask unceasing questions about what it means to exist and about what it all adds up to. The asking and trying out of answers is as fundamental to our personhood as growing is to a tree. Recently, my son has started to understand that he's changing. He's noticed that he no longer fits into a favorite shirt. And he shows me how he sleeps somewhat diagonally in his toddler bed. He's been caught walking around the house with real scissors. "I'm a big kid now, and I can use these," he says. Passing a favorite spot on the beach, he tells me, "Remember when we used to play with trucks here? I loved those times." By this point, he's actually had a few different names. We called him Little Guy after he was born, and now I call him Mr. Man. His understanding of his own growth is a step in his growing, And he is increasingly a doubled being, a tree and a vine. As the tree grows, the vine twines, finding new holds on the shape that supports it. It's a process that will continue throughout his life. We change and change our view of that change for as long as we live. And now, from the September 26, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, from the Talk of the Town on the Runway section, like lichen. Lichen is made up of at least two organisms, fungus and algae, photosynthesizing in symbiotic harmony. The other day, the Brooklyn Museum was overtaken by lichen of unusual composition. The vast ruffled puddles that spread out across the museum floor, swirls of green, pink, brown, red, and yellow, were composed of approximately 20,000 chrysanthemums, carnations, zinnias, and coxcombs. They were the work of Emily Thompson, a New York flower designer whose tastes run toward the wild and the overgrown. Lichen is a pet fascination. I grew up in a place with very beautiful rocks, Thompson, who is from Vermont, said, and of course the best rocks are the ones that have developed lichen. Thompson trained as a sculptor before turning to flowers and has created projects for fashion shows, restaurants, and the White House. At last, she'd found a client willing to realize her long-standing fantasy of lichen-inspired floral arrangements. The fashion designer Ula Johnson, whose spring-summer 2023 collection was making its debut in the Brooklyn Museum's Beaux Arts atrium. Johnson's show was scheduled for 10 a.m. on Sunday, and flowers began arriving at 8 a.m. on Saturday. Thompson had biked over to greet the trucks. She was working with a team of 14 other florists who wore mostly black. Thompson, who has curly hair and wore reading glasses attached to a thick green chain, was dressed in a sturdy cotton shirt and forest green pants. She compared her look to a park ranger uniform. After several freight elevator loads of blooms had been ferried upstairs, she gathered her team in a circle at the center of the 10,000-square-foot space. She handed around clipboards with a floor plan, referenced photographs of lichen in psychedelic colors, and pictures of a sample lichen flower mosaic she'd assembled at her Manhattan studio. "This is not a map you're going to follow," she said. The floor plan showed what looked like five continents of irregular size and shape, to be carpeted with the steamless heads of flowers placed flat on the ground. "What I really want to see is your own ideas of how the colors blend and contrast," she explained. Also marked on the plan was the Vogue shot, the path down the runway that press cameras would capture in their definitive photographs. "Ideally, things would not get too pretty. Seduction, repulsion, always," Thompson said. The florist set to work laying flowers on cotton tarps they'd spread across sections of the floor. Thompson started building a wall of crabapple branches, one of the few elements of the installation to rise more than an inch off the ground. "It's just like being a beaver," she said. Her dam aloft and sturdy, she paused to take a lap around the atrium to examine the patterns taking shape on the tarps. Chrysanthemums with pale lavender petals tipped in neon green nestled beside crinkly burgundy carnations edged in pink, interrupted by ripples of yellow coxcombs. "I love this awful gray-purple," Thompson said, pointing at a clump of carnations. "It's like a corpse, a rotting corpse." The progress excited her. "It's so much better than when we made it in the studio. It's so much better with all these human brains." The progress, however, was slow. Actual lichen often grows less than a millimeter a year. "Smush your carns," she advised the team. That way, the blossoms would take up more space. "We've got to crank. I want to see 50% soonish." After lunch, she walked to the vantage point of the Vogue shot and surveyed the space, hands on hips. She considered pitching in on the tarps, but she trusted the other florists more, because they'd been at it for hours. "There's a weird communion that happens," she said. "Your minds meld a bit." Ula Johnson was scheduled to inspect the lichen early that evening. I'm very hands-on, she explained. Thompson spent the remaining time calling in favors from flower vendors. More pink mums were on the way. Florists are always making something out of spit and toothpaste, she said. Johnson, when she arrived, worried that the patches of green and brown looked too much like camouflage. The brown is killing me a little, she told Thompson. She's taking out the ugly, Thompson said to a colleague. But this was to be expected. The work of the mind-melded florist was being subsumed into the event's larger ecosystem. A minutes-long fashion show brought into existence a teeming biome that dissolved almost as quickly as it took shape. By Saturday night, the atrium was full of photographers, electricians, lighting technicians, carpenters, and musicians with dramatic hair, in addition to Johnson's pack of closely conferring, mostly blonde staffers. A migratory flock of models arrived on Sunday morning, followed by the show's 325 invited guests, many of whom paused to photograph the pools of flowers before taking their seats. The scavengers, a team from an event cleanup service called Garbage Goddess, were the last to appear. They came after the show, wearing plant-dyed overalls, and transported the now wilting flowers to a compost facility on Long Island. This story was written by Molly Fisher. And now, three poems from the October 10th, 2022 issue from Musical Tables by Billy Collins. 3 a.m. Only my hand is asleep, but it's a start. Flaubert, as he looked for the right word, several wrong words appeared in his window. Elegy. I have turned over all 52 cards on the kitchen table. Still, I think you must be hiding somewhere in the deck. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.